Welcome back, everyone, to Red Spotlight Entertainment. I'm Alexis, and I'm joined today by David, of course, here for the podcast that gets into everything coming out of the world of movies and more. This is going to be episode number 519. We're going to get into a number of movies that we have seen, but we haven't had the chance to actually talk about. Those films are going to include Running Man, the latest by Edgar Wright and Glenn Powell, Predator Into the Badlands, is that what it was called?
Predator Badlands.
Okay, I like my title better. Predator Into the Badlands, even though it makes no sense, whatever. Alongside also reviews for Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein, which is, by the way, making a huge splash. People are really watching this. So hey, the Netflix effect seemingly worked out in its favor this time around, even though it robbed it of a international, or I guess national-wide release, but okay. And then also Rental Family, the latest by Searchlight Pictures and Brendan Fraser. I don't know. Did I miss one? Is there another movie that we wanted to get into? I'm sure.
For me, yes. The Carpenter's Son.
Oh, yes, yes. Okay. Yeah, I forgot.
No, yeah, I forgot to mention
that one. It's a lot of different movies that is happening, that are happening right now, and that we want to definitely for sure get into. So that's going to be today's show. And more here on Red Spotlight number 500. I got it. 519. Okay. So much is definitely happening. We're recording this. This is November the 24th of 2025. This is the Thanksgiving holiday week. And as happens every single time we get to this week, we are so overwhelmed, like unbelievably inundated with the any number of projects. And it feels like maybe more so this year, because at any given point, I mean, the things to discuss include what we're going to be talking about just now, which have been out, but also are going to include eventually Wicked for Good, Zootopia 2, Stranger Things 5. Right now, if you want to watch in limited release, there is Hamnet by Chloe Zhao, I believe Sentimental Value, a new international awards contender featuring Elle Fanning and Stellan Skarsgård, and also it being, I think, an appropriate week for it to make its debut. Thankfully, Netflix has been merciful enough to give it a few, showtimes and theaters this week. We're going to have the debut of the third entry of the Knives Out anthology, if you want to call it, with Daniel Craig and Rian Johnson, Wake Up Dead Man, this time with Josh O'Connor coming along, which many, many people, of course. I mean, look, it's a Rian Johnson film, so expect it to be no less than great, because all of his movies are, just for a start. We're kind of excited to talk about all of those movies as we get further along the line. I do want to just make one quick mention of, I guess we should mention programming, right, for the upcoming month. There's one that we're thinking about that we're not going to comment on because we're not sure about it, so that we're not going to mention that one. But we're about to finish the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. reaction commentary series for season 3. Those should be done this month, and we will be taking a month off from that for David and Alexis to resume their Percy Jackson series reactions coming in December. And I'm sure, David, you could just tell the little shimmy he gave. He's very much looking forward to that particular season. And of course, they're huge avid readers of that series, of course, as well. So if you are so inclined, you can go ahead and find the initial reactions to the first season on this channel if you so want to do so. I would recommend you should. So that's what's happening on our channel. And of course, I mean, there's a big kahuna that we haven't even talked about yet happening in December, which is called Avatar Fire and Ash. So there's a lot of, I mean, look, I'll tell you this. I feel like the summer movie season, quite frankly, in many ways, I feel, especially in the last few years, certainly since post-COVID, has been rather lackluster. I think for me, this is my movie season. This is my, I guess, my equivalent to the excitement one would have for a summer movie season. Like, to me, this is when so many things just like happen, and I'm just like, I feel like I'm you know, running a marathon just to be able to like get to all of them. And I know we can't get to all of them, but we can try the very best we can. So that's what's happening right now. And then also this month is when, you know, we have Critics' Choice and Golden Globe nominations. And they're the very first groups that are going to be kind of like letting us know who's in and who's not as far as awards are concerned. On the very date that I want to say we're recording this, the Critics' Choice, and I don't think they usually do this, but for this year, because they're so desperate to be the first people to get out there, they announced their shortlists, and Sinners received the most mentions. They're not nominations yet because we're not at that phase, but the most mentions with 13, that means the movie came up in 13 different categories for potential nominations. So that bodes very well for it. Other contenders include One Battle After Another, Wicked for Good, and a few other movies. As far as by the way, none of these included, I want to say, acting. So to be clear, that may or may not affect overall with Critics' Choice. But this is a conversation that Peter and I have been having lately about, like, okay, what are the movies that are being discussed? Well, there are a couple of films that we should probably look to as far as potential contenders. And this is more for an educational purpose, for people who want to know, like, what's being talked about. And then also, if people have an interest in the movie themselves, right? So I want to open up here a Letterboxd so I can go ahead and have that ready to go in. Well, you know what? Let me just put it on my iPad. But one of the contenders that I'm seeing right here is called Sentimental Value. That is a movie with Elle Fanning and Stellan Skarsgård. And I believe it's also an international feature. So here's the official description. This was directed by the Swedish, I want to say name, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce it correctly, Joachim Trier. He's previously known for directing the 2021 movie The Worst Person in the World, which got a lot of recognition back in 2021. And this is the description for Sentimental Value. Sisters Nora and Agnes reunite with their estranged father, the charismatic Gustav, a once-renowned director who offers stage actress Nora a role in what he hopes will be his comeback film. When Nora turns it down, she soon discovers he has given her part to an eager young Hollywood star. Interesting concept there. Another film that is, let's see, that is being discussed in this particular moment, if I can find it right here. We haven't really talked about this one, but Marty Supreme, the Timothy Chalamet movie that is directed by Josh Safdie.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to make sure that people are clear on this. Timmy don't miss.
Yeah.
Timmy don't miss. And then when you have one of the Safdie brothers, who apparently maybe is the better Safdie, who knows, a ping pong drama set in New York City during the 1950s, where up and coming table tennis star Marty Mauser goes to hell and back in pursuit of greatness. Could this be it? Could this be the role that gets him his Oscar?
It looks like he's just going to ham it up, and I like the concept itself just sounds funny. I like it.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to be like maybe a fast-paced, frenetic, kind of energetic movie. So that's definitely one that's, and I want to say it did get nominations for sure. Another one directed by Clint Bentley. This is Train Dreams, which is with Joel Edgerton, Felicity Jones, Kerry Condon, and William H. Macy. A logger leads a life of quiet grace as he experiences love and loss during an era of monumental change in the early 20th century America. I want to say when I had Netflix opened earlier today, it was already available to stream. I don't, let me just double check on that real quick. Maybe it's, maybe not, maybe it'll be coming soon, but I want to say that it's somewhere in the ether. Hamnet, which is the, I want to say, fourth feature by Chloe Zhao. She, her previous films were The Writer, the Best Picture winning Nomadland, and the eternally underappreciated and pilloried Eternals, unfairly so, I might add. Here is Hamnet, which stars Jesse Buckley, who apparently Jesse Buckley is already kind of like the lead for Best Actress, which is interesting because the previous Academy contender from Chloe Zhao, Nomadland, won Best Actress with Frances McDormand. So maybe she could be repeating there with this particular movie. But it also features Paul Mescal, which, of course, he's also one of those new, like, hot up-and-comers who are just, like, everywhere and has not so far flamed out. This is the powerful story of love and loss that inspired the creation of Shakespeare's timeless masterpiece, Hamlet. I am intrigued about this. That's, I mean, if you're going getting into Shakespeare, that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Curious there. And I'm sure there were a few other ones, but the other ones I think we already know of. Sinners, One Battle After Another. Frankenstein also got a lot of mentions too. Let me just go ahead and look at what I had sent to you guys earlier today. That way I can go ahead and have it here. So, Sinners received the most mentions on this shortlist, but also tied with Nine Apiece, Frankenstein, Wicked for Good, F1 the movie. I don't know about how far F1 will get, but definitely F1 is, I'm sure, a well-liked movie. I think it's probably the dad movie of this year. I mean, look at the director. It's Joseph Kosinski. He made Top Gun Maverick. So this is basically Top Gun Maverick, but with like speeding cars.
Mm-hmm. I think it could probably just get nominated for something for like sound design, maybe some cinematography. Probably.
Yeah, I don't think this will be in the 10, quite frankly. I don't think it was that. I mean, not for nothing, F1 was wildly successful. I mean, it was in theaters for months, and I think it did cross $500 million, which, if I'm not mistaken, I don't know where Fantastic Four landed. I know where this is going into random territory here. Let me just go ahead and look at the box office for Fantastic Four, The First Steps. Stupid title, by the way. I don't know why Marvel is so insistent on just like giving these like, but what is the next Spider-Man movie even called? Spider-Man.
Brand New Day?
You see?
I think I'm wrong. Am I confusing it with, I feel like I'm kind of confusing it with like Brave New World or something like that with Captain America, but.
Yeah. Dumb title. I mean, I also want to say, Flat, before I even get to Wicked, dumb title. I'm sorry. What was wrong with just saying it was part two?
Mm-hmm.
Wicked for Good? Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Whatever. So it looks like the Fantastic Four movie this year, worldwide, only made $521.8 million, which, by the way, that's embarrassing. That legitimately is embarrassing for a Marvel movie with Fantastic Four. I mean, I think it's to be expected with like the box office today. So put, okay, so 521. Let me go ahead and look at the box office for F1. Wow. 631.
Mm.
631. So that means that F1 did gross considerably more than Fantastic Four. And let me just, for that matter, I don't remember, where did Superman finish? I think it was in the sixth range.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Superman, wow, 617. So F1 made more than literally all the superhero movies this year, which is really interesting. So I feel like if it's that widely seen, don't underestimate the steak eaters, block, voting block of the Academy. That's a term that was coined by Ann Thompson of IndieWire, which is like kind of a name to describe how just like the very kind of like standard, just generic palette of a particular older kind of Academy voter. So maybe this could come back into play. I don't know if it'll be a major player, though, quite frankly. And I also don't know what a major player Wicket for Good is going to be, because I just don't think that, no matter for the box office success that it's having, and I'm sure it had like a huge opening this weekend, I don't believe the movie ever had a chance of being as liked as the first movie for a lot of reasons. Wicked ended up being a phenomenon, and that huge Wicked fan base came out to support it. And it also caught a lot of new people like us who were new to the story, and we enjoyed it. But I feel like, and I know that we'll get to this when we get to our review of Wicked, but I know that, you know, Alexis was kind of like dancing around certain spoilers. I haven't seen the movie just yet, but I do know the story of Wicked Part 2, because I mean, a year ago we did kind of like, we were curious to see what was the source material, and it was weird. It was, to, for lack of a better word, it was weird. The things that happened in Part 2, and I feel like just by knowing where that story was going to go, I don't think this ever had a chance of being as good, number one, or as like well-liked as the first one. So I don't expect this to... I don't think it'll get snubbed like Joker Folie à Deux, like Crash and Burn, because that was a special kind of like, like disaster. But it's well liked enough where it's going to get a couple of mentions. I'm sure it'll get nominated for costumes, for the sets, for the makeup. That's going to be like guaranteed. Whether or not it gets Ariana again or Cynthia Erivo again, I don't know. I'm rather dubious about that. I would not put money on that happening for sure.
Yeah.
Of course, it depends on like what the field is, David.
Yeah, the second part just kind of had like no chance, like the first one came out, because even for fans of the Broadway musical were like, yeah, the second half of this is kind of weird. It's not as good as the first part.
They were
part.
Telling us this a year ago.
Yeah.
They were saying this a year ago.
And then also like the biggest song of the whole musical was shown.
Defying Gravity.
Yeah, it was shown in the first one, and it's like, okay, so what about the other ones? Is it not as good? Is there no like epic conclusion song to this? Like, what the heck? So yeah, it kind of never had a chance, really.
It never had a chance. And then also, I mean, I never expected John Chu or any of the people involved to actually make any deviations. If I were a producer involved with the production, okay, you want to make two movies, I can level with you. Maybe we can make more money out of that. But can we look into maybe changing some things for part two? Because I feel like even if you pay attention to fan circles, where the story goes for part two of the play, people don't really like it as much as the original one. So maybe we can tweak with things. I don't know. That's just my mindset getting into it. It's like, yeah, for me, I would not count on this movie being a major player. So that's where we are right now. I don't know. Right now, if you were to ask me to put money on something, I would just say the default for Best Picture and Best Director would be One Battle After Another.
Yeah.
And until something else comes in, we'll see. I will say right now, I would personally champion Guillermo del Toro for at least a nomination for Best Director. To me, it's kind of ridiculous how, I don't know who it was. Was it Variety? That was like in their predictions, they were like, John M. Chu for Best Director for Wicked for Good. And I'm like, but I didn't see Del Toro's name mentioned there. And I'm like, well, and thankfully, there might be more of a possibility now, because unlike Nightmare Alley, which nobody saw, which is terrible that nobody saw it, because it was a masterpiece, honestly. I think it still to this day features Bradley Cooper's single best performance, but no one, I guess, wants to say it. But with Frankenstein, the views speak for themselves. It's getting noticed. And I have to say, Guillermo has been on a blaze trail with this Frankenstein campaign. He's been, I think, in person at a lot of these screenings. And he's, you know, I think, look, Guillermo is just an amazing individual to just listen to. He's also been getting a lot of attention with literally ending every event he does by getting the entire crowd to chant "fuck AI," which, I mean, you gotta love the guy for, you know, just he never fails to be himself. That's what I think that's what people love about that guy. Mm-hmm. And especially you can see it really go into a lot of the movies that he makes for sure. So that's kind of where we're going to be. I know that there, 2 weeks ago, there were a lot of people who were saying, oh yeah, Ariana is going to win for best supporting actress for Wicked for Good. And I'm like, guys, just wait till the reviews come out. I don't think it's going to pan out that way. Mm-hmm. I would be shocked if that actually happens, quite frankly. No, I don't think that's happening. Now, I haven't heard too much talk, but maybe people might consider Jacob Elordi. And if they do, wow, that would be amazing if they do. That would be incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll get into all that and more. But I do want to go ahead and now we have that out of the way with. We're about 20 minutes or so into the podcast. There is the Zootopia of it all, because we're in the week where Disney usually releases a big animated movie. What is about to happen in these next few days is going to be hailed by the trades, Variety, and the Hollywood Reporter as the big comeback by Bob Iger. They're going to write articles that are going to glaze him. They're going to say, you know what? He was right. We shouldn't doubt him. He just knows how to make money. And of course, there's a kernel of truth to that, but it also is kind of like wrapped around a lot of misrepresentation and a complete lack of context for what happened. None of these articles are going to be written. By the way, this is in connection to the what is going to be historic box office debut of Zootopia 2. China, which is a whole separate conversation, and their taste in movies is a whole separate genre at that. But for whatever reason, they love Zootopia. And I want to say I read an article in the last couple of days where in China alone, it's looking very likely that it's going to open to over $200 million. In China alone, which, by the way, blows past any record. I think the pre-ticket sales blew past the records that were set previously by Avatar: The Way of Water. So we're talking about a behemoth here in China.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean to say nothing of how it's going to do, which it will probably do very well in other markets, you know, internationally. And of course, we haven't gotten to, of course, the Americans, which of course the Americans love it. They love it when Disney just repackages the same old crap, puts it in their face, and yay, we have a sequel. We love Shrek 1000. We love Toy Story a million. We're going to go ahead and spend all of our money on this because that's all we want. So the current projections have it at opening all over the world with over $500 million. Over $500 million probably in its first week. So because of that, you're going to have a lot of articles already. I'm probably would put money on them already being written somewhere and saved on some databases. You know, singing Bob Iger's praises, saying that he is the only one who could come here and fix it. And of course, none of those articles are going to mention the fact that most of the horrible turnarounds that happened during Bob Chapek's run were direct manifestations and consequence, and was basically a direct consequence of the policies of Bob Iger. Bob Chapek was the guy on top for like, what, 2 years? Do you really think he had a meaningful, like, lasting effect on how the company was run? Now, you know, let's not deny Bob Chapek his incompetence. He had that and more, which is why he was fired. But here's my thing. Every year, since Bob Iger came back and they canceled all original movies and all they're doing is sequel after sequel, it's the same story, right? In fact, I mean, Lilo and Stitch, Moana 2, Inside Out 2. It comes out. Everybody and their mom goes and sees it. Eventually, it makes $1 billion. Each of those films had different reactions. Inside Out 2 cast a spell over people, and they all are convinced it's an amazing movie, when in fact it's not. But either way, no one ever mentions that movie, right? Mm. No one has brought that movie up at all since it came out like over a year and a half ago. Okay. Moana 2 and Lilo and Stitch, on the other hand, came out and were destroyed. Destroyed in the reviews because they were not very good. In fact, I'm sure they were quite bad. Did it matter? No. No. It did not matter. People went to go and watch them. Now, I feel, ultimately, as far as the bottom line is concerned, these executives do not care about like quality anymore. They think they figured out that, oh, we can just put in the bare minimum, even less than that, and people will still go and watch them. But don't count on that happening forever and ever and ever. Because I do believe fundamentally, and you tell me if you feel differently, David, but I think that it is, for however much it has helped Disney in the short term with making more money again, I think it's also helped to accelerate a very damaging narrative against Disney at the same time. For every amount of dollar they made, because these projects have been so poorly made and have had no impact whatsoever on the public consciousness, I mean, you can feel that. I mean, you can say, look, Moana 2, Inside Out 2, and Lilo and Stitch were heavily seen movies. But those have all failed to live with people. Whereas, I mean, can you honestly say, aside from Encanto, Encanto is the only exception. And I'm not even sure I would put it in this group of movies that I am saying here, because Encanto came out years earlier. But like, while K-pop Demon Hunters and Wicked didn't make the money that Moana 2, Zootopia 2 will make, Inside Out 2, or Lilo and Stitch did, K-pop Demon Hunters and Wicked, you could just see it when you walk out on the streets, is a movie that has resonated, it penetrated, and it is being lived with so many people around the world.
Yeah. For sure.
Can you say Disney has done that with those movies that made billions of dollars? No, not one of them. Not one of them. And even the audacity, right? A year ago, when Moana 2, quote unquote, because still not even a real movie. It's a Disney Plus 6-episode series that was glued together. But the audacity of those songwriters for saying, oh, in a month from now, everyone's going to be singing our songs. A year has passed. No one even remembers the names of the people who said that, much less the lyrics of those songs, mm-hmm. much less the movie itself. So all of that is a preamble to say, this is a huge movie, Zootopia 2, coming out. And we haven't had the actual long form critic printed reviews, because the embargo doesn't lift until the day that it opens. I want to say it's opening tomorrow or the day before, which I don't know about that. Not a great look, but I don't know if you had a chance, David, to peek at what's being said. I've looked at some of reactions of people and it kind of comes across like a lot of nothing. Hmm. I'm seeing a lot of reactions of like, it's really funny. The jokes are great. Judy Hopp and Nick are still amazing. There have been some people who've said that the social commentary is just as good, if not better. On the flip side, there have been some people who've said the social commentary takes a clear back seat as compared to the original. I'm seeing a lot of, it's a worthy sequel. I'm seeing a lot of, it's nice. It's funny. But not one of these reactions, I think, have really answered the question of, is this great? I feel like if it was great, they would be saying it. I'm not getting from that from the reactions. While still positive, because of course the initial reactions are always going to be positive. But I'm also not seeing or reading from any of these reactions that this was a movie that needed to exist. And when I say needed to exist, it is, look, every sequel has a huge burden to come up with how it justifies itself existing in terms of like expanding on what the original film was. Most sequels, if all you're doing is the first movie all over again, because of money, that's why sequels have had a bad rap for like forever. Honestly, forever. So it's just, this is why it just feels so gross, David. I don't know if you feel, I know maybe you block it out, but for me, it's like, it's hard to block it out because it just makes me feel so gross that a movie that honestly, it might be all right. And I'm sure it might be quite entertaining, but like, it just hurts to see these very cynical decisions. The decision to make this movie was so cynical and so motivated by pure slop and greed and confidence that the public would not care, would not give a damn how good or not it was. But just the fact that they just slapped the title that was going to sell, and then what do people do? They come out in droves and they reward this kind of behavior. And it just hurts. It hurts that this is what people choose to give their money to, where there is like all of these other amazing stories out there that are just not being widely seen. Mm-hmm. So that's where I'm at. What were your thoughts on the Zootopia of it all, and your thoughts about all this?
No, I mean, I agree with you that like it does suck that you know exactly why this movie was made, and it was just because, yeah, money grab for sure, when there is like great potential to tell another good story, one that's different from the last one. One, I wouldn't say maybe it could be better. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. That's always a hard part to say with any sequel, where it's like, can you really top off the first? But just the potential of like, you could do something different here and make it stand out like all your other ones. I mean, you can almost say, I'm sure people might have thought this when Toy Story came out. You know, when the second one was coming out, we probably would have had this conversation where we would be like, how the fuck can you top the first one? Like, where can you go? And they did it. You know, there was some little things. They went, you know, deeper into Woody's, popularity within the world and all that. And they, you know, added a little conflict to it. But it was different from the last one. Like, you can't really say for sure that they're the same movie, but you can tell with Zootopia 2 that it's just the same story of with the same commentary too. And it's just like, okay, then why make this in the first place? Moana 2 did have an interesting idea going on, but something
for a show, you mean? Because it wasn't meant to be a movie. It was,
I mean,
show that they had to Frankenstein's monster into a movie.
Yeah, I mean, either or, really. Like, it could have worked either or, but maybe it was because they put it down into a 2-hour movie, or maybe it was just the writers themselves that like he didn't do. There was something about it that just didn't capture us, and now we're almost forgetting about it. So it's just, yeah, it's really annoying seeing these sequels and just knowing that you're not really putting much effort to it. So yeah. And I don't know. It just They could do better.
It's just so annoying to me. Look, there's a lot of annoying layers to this. This is the part that it gets, I feel like maybe it's even worse than it's ever been before all the other times too, because like, well, look, to your point, and let's tackle it a couple of these at a time. Could there absolutely be the potential for, I mean, look, the Toy Story films themselves somehow end up pulling through every single time. And look, let's be real. I've never been more skeptical of a Toy Story film existing than this new one that we're going to have. But I'm not going to rule out that maybe. Because this franchise seemingly ends up pulling it through all the previous times. This one, to me, has the most up against it because they've already ended the story like three times, mm-hmm. two times. I don't know how many times they've ended the story. So, like, okay, we have another one and we know why it was greenlit in the first place. So, but maybe, who knows? On the other end of things, Disney and Pixar have proven that the whole thing going on with Toy Story sequels and them being pretty good is kind of the exception to the rule, right? And I'm not here to say that the majority of the sequels that they've made are bad. They're just very clearly, with some exceptions. Again, preference and taste factors into this as well. But I'm just going to take a step back and take my own personal, I think, preference aside and just examine the legacies of all of these, like, let me just say, probably post 2010, post Toy Story 3 sequels, right? And I feel like, and you tell me this if I'm wrong here, but most of them are just not thought of as anywhere near as good or as memorable. Cars 2, Cars 3, Finding Dory, Incredibles 2, Monsters University, Toy Story 4 certainly is divisive among the Toy Story community for sure. That's just in the Pixar end of things. Then comes with Disney Animation, there is Frozen 2, which also in itself is quite divisive. Ralph Breaks the Internet, also itself quite divisive. Then now Moana 2 and Zootopia 2. And by the way, there's a huge subgenre of movie that was not included in this that is even more egregious than useless sequels. And that is the Disney live action remake, which really has become a genre into itself, basically. And this is why I'm telling you, Disney should be careful about not thinking this is going to go on forever. Because, look, and we should also say, like, the whole reason why we're having all of these, like, sequels out of nowhere is because Disney hit a wall with COVID. And truthfully, if we're being honest, sure, the quality of Strange World and Wish weren't very good. But if we're looking at the overall, and Lightyear, but if we're looking at the original movies that came out with Pixar and Disney post-2020, Soul, Onward, Luca, Turning Red, Elemental, Elio, Raya and the Last Dragon, Encanto. Good. Very good. What was the problem? Disney made a colossal mistake. They made a colossal mistake, which we've already talked about many, many times. But we all know what happened with COVID. And they ended up devaluing the brand of their animated movies from both animation studios and where people just expect them to be on streaming now, unless it's a sequel. Yeah. Unless it's something they already know. Which then brings me to the Elio of it all. Why is it that, and this is where I think the most disappointment comes from, these critics or fans that Disney invites to the screenings so they can, like, and they deliberately pick the ones that they know are going to, you know, write positive reactions. But I'm just, and this also extends itself to just like the Oscarologists and the Oscar pundits about like what's going to be nominated or not. I'm just like, look, to me, it's just a bad look. Maybe Zootopia 2 is a fine movie. I don't know. I haven't seen it, but I have my doubts. But what I'm not doubtful of is the quality of Elio, which is a genuinely great movie, but we're not allowed to say it's a great movie because it got carpetbagged in so many different ways. It was a huge box office bomb, and then Disney threw it under the bus by basically creating a scandal. It legit created a scandal to distract, which didn't do its job, quite frankly. And then, of course, there's the K-pop demon hunters of it all, which is like, there's this whole other community of people who are like, ha, 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 K-pop is amazing. Elio, fuck you. Literally all over the place for like months. So, which is really bad because, dude, that's the kind of movie we need to be supporting, like original movies, original animated movies. Like, what's going to happen to the next Pixar movie, Hoppers, when it comes out in March? Probably isn't going to come out. And if it does come out in theaters, who's going to watch it? That's what it's come to. And this is only reinforcing the worst instincts of the people whose job it is to decide what project lives, what project dies, what project goes to theaters, what project goes to streaming. And this is the sad part is, if Zootopia and Elio switched places, I bet you the story would be no different. It wouldn't matter. If, let's just say Elio comes out this week, could it maybe get a few more eyeballs on it because if it's holiday week? Sure. But it's not going to be Zootopia 2. It's not going to be Moana 2. Whereas if you put Zootopia 2 in the summertime, it would have done just as well, if not better. We know this because, of course, Wish and Strange World collapsed. They collapsed. But they collapsed for two very big reasons. They weren't very good, and the studio didn't push them. And, of course, streaming. So, and we all know the story there. So, it just creates a very complicated situation. But speaking a little bit about that live action remake genre, in the last time since we recorded, Disney dropped the trailer for the Moana live action, in quotation marks, live action remake. I didn't watch the whole thing. I just saw the parts that people were, let's just say, most paying attention to. And I have to tell you, David, I feel like this is an example of why Disney should take great care in reining in their overconfidence. Now, is this going to deter people from watching it? No. Will this make $1 billion? Yes. But we should take note that even more so than any previous live action remake trailers, this one specifically, I feel more than any of the other ones that came before and more. And you tell me again if I'm wrong here. But to my eye, it got the single most round of negativity I've seen. Like, just from the get-go, when it dropped, people were like, ugh. And then even just making immediate accusations of Disney running us through an AI filter. Your thoughts, David?
No, I didn't like the trailer at all. It just didn't look nice. Obvious bad CGI. I don't know if they're rushing, you know, to get this done or what. But it just doesn't look good. And it makes sense that this is getting so much hate. I feel like the reasons why some of the other ones didn't, I mean, not counting Little Mermaid or Snow White, but like Beauty and the Beast, Cinderella, and all that, it's just because this is just for Moana. This is just way too soon to remake it. Like,
the movie isn't even 10 years old, mind you.
Yeah. Like, already you want to just replace it, you know?
Like, at least Lilo and Stitch was over 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I had enough time. Moana, like, I feel like it was this month, only 9 years ago, that Moana came out.
Yeah. And so.
And then Moana 2 came out just last year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's like, it just feels.
And also, like,
I think they fucked themselves with the release of these projects.
Yeah, and not only that, but like with Moana specifically, like, I'm not saying like the past animations were bad or anything, but animation's been improving. Animation has gotten more and more beautiful as time has gone on. And when you show us, like, you know, almost peak of what you can do with this 3D animation style, and you show this slop, like, of course you're going to get hate for it, you know? This is nowhere near as pretty as the animated one. And yeah, it's just, of course, yeah, it was going to get hate from the beginning. It was just ridiculous. And I feel like also people who, you know, like us, talk about these movies, you know exactly why Dwayne Johnson is making this movie or wants to be in this movie. So it's just, there's also that kind of thing behind it too. I mean, I don't think people are hating on Dwayne Johnson specifically, but it's kind of like, we know why this movie was kind of being made. So
yeah, for me, the Dwayne curse continues. That's for sure. I feel like all of his movies are just awful. All of them. I think he's a terrible actor. Well, maybe not a terrible actor. I don't like him personally.
He's a fine actor and all that. The last movies that he's been on, just pure action stuff. You know, he really could have been like great, great action guy. You know, as good as Arnold Schwarzenegger himself. But like, for one thing, I think just the Black Adam thing just completely ruined his image in a sense.
Good. And good. I'm glad.
So there's that. Some people were saying some good things about Smashing Machine and all that, which I really wouldn't mind if you go back there or, like, you know, try to focus on that more. Maybe we can change it up a bit, but yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, so we just wanted to get that unpleasant tree out of the way with. But I feel like go ahead and give us a good, good enough, anyway, transition to talk about Wicked for good. Right? Let's just go ahead and do it. So, let me go ahead and pull up right here, Wicked for good. David, you guys saw this
early. I didn't see it.
What?
I haven't seen it.
What are we doing here for? I thought you did see it then.
I thought you saw it.
I didn't see this.
Oh, shit.
Oh, my God. Oh, shit. I'm sorry. I thought you guys went to go see this. I thought you had an early fan screening or something.
It was just my sister and my cousin that saw it early. So, yeah. So then we should just skip it, I guess, for now. And
I mean, clearly we should, right? Because, like, we didn't. I'm sorry.
I thought you saw it, and I was like, okay, just give your movie.
No. I. Here, I'll just. I mean, Alexis sent thoughts. Mm-hmm. I just assumed she knew that I thought I told you guys I didn't watch this. Didn't I? Maybe not until we were just recording. So, this is awkward.
Yeah.
This has never happened before. Okay. Well,
I said we just save it for a different time.
Should we play Alexis's thoughts or? We should just wait then.
We should just wait.
Yeah, this is just. Okay. Well, that was a curveball, people. I, that may be your first that's ever happened. Okay. Let's go ahead and get into some of these other films. Let's go ahead and go with Running Man, since you watched that one. Okay. Edgar Wright. This is also starring Glenn Powell, Josh Brolin, Michael Cera, Colman Domingo, Lee Pace, and other movie people. Hunt him down. Desperate to save his sick daughter, working class Ben Richards is convinced by the running man's charming but ruthless producer to enter the deadly competition game as a last resort. But Ben's defiance, instincts, and grit turn him into an unexpected fan favorite and a threat to the entire system. As ratings skyrocket, so does the danger. And Ben must outwit not just the hunters, but a nation addicted to watching him fall. Here are some reactions. Isaac Feldberg, supremely entertaining, but also approached with surprising integrity, especially in how Edgar Wright finds a way to connect Bachman's grim, hyper-televised dystopia to his own instincts toward glib, violent showmanship. The tone largely works, its grungy and bloodied tenor aligned with our politics and supporting the corny but welcome raised middle finger attitude. Far from perfect, but Powell is undeniably an undeniably credible leading man. Really loved his performance in this, and Wright's direction is so kinetic that the film blasts by for a very long while. Pity about the third act, which both literally and figuratively can't land the plane, but even that has Lee Pace going for it. That was Isaac Feldman. Here is Bailey Parkinson. Dire from the second shot onwards. This was another 2025 chase movie where I couldn't fathom a single creative decision that was made anywhere from start to finish. Impossible to believe this is from the same guy who did Hot Fuzz. A fascinating case study of great set design but poor world building, both physically and textually. I can see it's all real, but I don't believe anything I see. Tragically miscast, too. The ripped hunk with the pretty smile is not an everyman. The Hunger Games goes nationwide, should have the sauce, but this wasn't given the detail or characterization or even the internal logic it needed to explosively thrive. The whole movie should have been set within 24 hours and juiced the dynamic of, oh fuck, they'll find me, hide and seek tension with the more kinetic, we gotta move, type escapes. Would have left 20 minutes in if I hadn't dragged two friends along with me. Jesus Christ. Oh my god, that's bad. Here's another one by Brian. He's known as a Willem Dafoe enthusiast. That's all I can say. Crazy double feature with Hamnet, but why... But why not? Perfectly fine popcorn flick that's stylish and fun, but overstays its welcome a bit by the end with a bloated runtime. I think they had cut if they had cut this down to 90 minutes, I'd have enjoyed it a lot more. But regardless, it's got some fun action sequences. The ending is a complete mess, LMAO. But I was a bit baffled. I was a bit baffled. But I'd be lying if I said I didn't enjoy this film overall. Give me one. Let's see. Brendan Hodges. I was among those who grew up with the Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz movies as sacred objects, which is why I'm so bummed this is a sloppy bore. A genre head like Wright should know better. The action is cut to pieces. The plot is full of sloppy contrivances. Even if you Pepsi challenged the movie, nobody would know it was directed by Edgar Wright. Damn. The slick transitions, kinetic camera moves, and cut montages are largely gone. Last Night in Soho is a broken movie, but there's nothing close here to the formal flair of a three-way dance number. I'm looking, let's see here. Jonathan Fuji. fun enough, but what happened to the Edgar Wright sauce? Ryan McQuaid, we are going to need to talk about what happened to Edgar Wright, a film fully carried on its back by its movie star and held back by its lost storyteller behind the camera. Puzzling and bland. Jeff Zhang, obsessed with being arc and topical when it should have just tried being a good action movie. It had all the ingredients, but I will say that it's maybe one of the biggest cases of actors innocent in recent memory. Interesting mix of reactions.
Yeah.
Just wanted to put that out there. David, your thoughts?
Yeah, it's kind of tough because, like, I agree with everyone's criticisms and all that, but I...
all of them?
Not all of them. There's, I'll explain, but, like, okay. I enjoyed the movie. I did have fun with it. I like Glenn Powell as an actor. I think he's, you know, he's really fun to watch. I liked him in Twisters. So there's that. I like the story.
I thought he was really good in Anyone But You. I don't know if you watched that one, but that was also a different movie.
Not yet.
With Sydney Sweeney.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I thought he was great. Thought the story was just fine. Action sequences were fine and all that. But what I do agree on is, like, this isn't Edgar Wright's best work. Like, I really do think this is, like, on the whole list,
the weakest movie of them all. It's
the weakest one, for sure. And mind you, I've seen...
So, here's a list. Baby Driver, Scott Pilgrim versus the World, Last Night in Soho, Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, The World's End, and The Running Man.
Mm. So other than Running Man, I've seen four other movies of his. Baby Driver, Scott Pilgrim, Hot Fuzz, and Shaun of the Dead. And I mean, those ones are, I would say, like, not counting Running Man, Baby Driver is probably like his second to the least favorite movie of his, because mainly to do with the characters, but everything else is fucking fantastic. But yeah, it's just something about it. Like, even when I'm watching, I'm kind of like, I know you can do better. Like, you've done better before. Like, what the heck is this? But other than that, though, I still did enjoy it. I would probably watch this again. One of the things that I was just, like, disliking the most in some reviews is them bringing up the original Running Man. Yes, there are some things that I think plot-wise does it better. For one thing, the whole plot is taking place within like a day. I don't know, I think it's like 12 hours. That's the entire plot, whereas this one is like a whole month. I understood some people saying the how the main character gets the audience on his side and all that. That was pretty interesting, although I don't mind it on this one. You know, within 30 days, he's trying to... it's not so much that he's trying to get the audience's attention, but, like, the people who is surrounded by him, I think I enjoyed that more. And they're the ones spreading the word, making him the, I guess, the hero, the true hero that he should be. He should be shown as. And so that's what I liked in this newer version of it. And then this is kind of how I brought up in our last Shield vid reaction that we did and all that. Like, I hated how people were comparing the two, and I'm kind of like, come on, there's some really bad stuff about the original one. I mean, cheesy dialogue. Arnold, is not really that good of an actor in that time. And yeah, there's just so many problems with it, and I just don't like... I really don't like the comparisons of it. Again, yes, there were some things plot-wise that, yeah, they maybe could have taken note of, but still, it's not that good of a movie. Calm down. With this newer version, it was, I would say, it's an okay movie. If you like Glenn Powell in his past ones, you'll probably enjoy him in this, and you'll still get some fun action out of it.
Yeah, I feel like Glenn Powell is going to have should have soon ish a really great movie. as far as Edgar Wright is concerned, it doesn't surprise me. I'll just put it to you this way: the reaction to this movie, because I was one of the people that actually did watch his previous movie, Last Night in Soho, which was interesting, and then it wasn't. It wasn't an altogether bad movie, but I feel like it was one of those where I was like, I walked out of it and I'm like, I didn't really care about it at all. That's bad. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, could it be that maybe we're watching someone lose their sauce a bit? If that's the case, that would be unfortunate. But I mean, he's young enough. There's a lot more Edgar Wright movies that are going to be coming in the future. Mm-hmm. But it is, the last movie that he made that was regarded quite highly was Baby Driver in 2017, 8 years ago. So this is not a great look for him. I don't know. I'm not really crazy about Edgar Wright to begin with, or at least even like his best movies, they don't really do much for me. But especially if people are just like saying, wow, you could barely tell Edgar Wright was directing this.
Yeah. Uh-oh. It's just,
that's,
if you watch Hot Fuzz and then watch this one, you can tell there is a giant difference in style between the two, and
not for the better.
And not for the better. Yeah. And so it is kind of interesting to think about, like, what went wrong with this movie exactly? Like, what is it about it that you couldn't do what you're doing beforehand, you know? Especially when you look at Baby Driver, like I said, like, that probably is, at least for me, like, you know, second to the bottom of the list in his movies. He still had some amazing sequences going on. He had amazing editing and, you know, with the music working together with the editing and the action and all that. Like, what happened with Running Man? You know? So.
Yeah.
It's just.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy to think.
Yeah. I guess the next one we're going to get into is a movie called The Carpenter's Son, which is a Nicolas Cage film. This comes to us by the director Lofty Nathan, who previously directed Nothing of Note before. Okay. I couldn't tell you what any of this was. Deliver Us from Evil, a remote village in Roman-era Egypt explodes into spiritual warfare when a carpenter, his wife, and their child are targeted by supernatural forces. There are hardly any reviews for this one on this. Hardly anyone has seen it. What did you think?
I thought it was pretty good. This is basically just like Jesus Christ origin story or something.
Did they Pope Exorcist this thing? Is that what?
It wasn't that crazy. But okay. I mean, it's just basically imagine how Jesus Christ figured out that he is the Son of God, that he has these abilities and all that. And that's basically what the story goes into. And I think that's what I kind of found interesting about it. You know, he's curious about what the heck he's capable of, and he even starts questioning, you know, like, his family. I mean, I'll spoil it because not a lot of people are going to be watching this, but
yeah, it looks like nobody watched it.
Yeah, sadly. But you know, if you like Nicolas Cage, you know, he was pretty good in this. It is a pretty interesting story. And mind you, I do not like, don't care for like religious type stories or anything like that. So it's an interesting watch. It is a bit of a horror, kind of gory.
Careful, don't put yourself on a watch list and forget who's the president. We love religious films. What are you talking about?
The program. at the clip of Jesus Christ in South Park. the movie just took it its concept pretty interestingly. Enjoyed the ending and kind of what main character deals with, not Nicolas Cage, like his son Jesus Christ basically, and his sort of character arc into accepting his, I guess, role within this world. It was all pretty interesting. Good, you know, I don't think it was that long of a movie too. I think it might have been like an hour 40, maybe less. So easy watch. Again, bit of a horror, kind of gory moments and all that, if you're interested in that. If you're not, then maybe you won't like it. But yeah.
Okay. The next one we're going to get into is Predator Badlands, which comes to us by Dan Trachtenberg. Dan Trachtenberg is most known before for Prey, which got a lot of love by people on this podcast and all over the world. I do feel like it was a missed opportunity, as people say, that Prey itself was not in theaters, or it was more of a Hulu only release. And Dan Trachtenberg is also maybe more so known for directing 10 Cloverfield Lane back in 2016. Clearly this guy is a big Predator fan. I'm told that he directed some video games for Predator, if I'm not mistaken. So here is the Letterboxd description. Cast out from his clan, a young Predator finds an unlikely ally in a damaged android and embarks on a treacherous journey in search of the ultimate adversary. This stars Al Fanning and Demetrius Schuster Kalamontagi as Deck. Let me go ahead and let's see some reactions here. Matthew Kelly, the fact that at one point we didn't get a "get away from her, you bitch" shows a level of restraint most modern blockbusters can't imagine. You may not get this reference because that is Alien. So the second movie, Aliens, James Cameron's movie, is one of the most infamous lines in movie history, was when Sigourney Weaver is on like this walker and she goes up to the queen, Xenomorph, and she says to her, "Get away from her, you bitch." And then of course, what does last year's Alien Covenant do? Slavishly just recreates moments and gives them to characters that have no business saying them, but they're just making a moment just so we can wink and nod at the audience. Like, hey, we get you, right? You got us, you know this line. And it had one actor was like, "Get away from her, you bitch." So the fact that it's actually, basically Matthew is saying, it's like, this movie had no desire of any kind to make itself feel or reuse situations or downright lines from the original movie, and it was better for it. Thank you for that. All right, let's see who else. Patrick Willems, never thought that I would be going around telling people that the new Predator movie is a delight, but here we are. What a good time at the movies. Let's see here. Generally, I'm looking to see Brandon. Brandon Struzing said, "I bet I could survive a solid 7 minutes on that planet. Easy. Had such a blast with this. Big fan of that monkey thing that kind of looked like a Wallace Shawn running around pulling pranks and goofs. Saw this in 4DX and had a big dumb smile the entire time." Zoe Rose Bryant, "Every movie would be better with two Al Fannings." That's funny. Let's see here. Matt Singer, "I didn't know this was rated PG-13 or that there was some hand-wringing on the internet over that fact until after it was over. The joke is truly on anyone who skips this movie because they think it won't be gnarly enough for a Predator film. It's packed with violence, a lot of it pretty damn bloody. For example, at one point, the Predator still just stands still and lets an alien monster run at him and cuts itself in half on his plasma sword. Then the Predator grabs its split in twain entrails and hoists them to the sky in triumph. PG-13. What director Dan Trachtenberg did here strikes me as a rather ingenious exploitation of the MPAA's own nonsensical rules about violence. In Predator terms, it's like finding a bug that blows up on an alien planet and using it as a grenade against your enemies. There's plenty of viscera getting splashed around in the film, but it's all green or purple or milky white because all the characters are aliens and androids instead of humans. Creatures are slaughtered, aliens are beheaded, star beasts are ripped apart from the inside, but none of them are human and no one bleeds any red blood. So, PG-13. Interesting tangent. That was more of a tangent than a review, but interesting observation because there was a lot of violence. You don't think of it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see here. Matt Donato. It's official. Dan Trachtenberg is the Yautja Whisperer. His third Predator entry, Predator Badlands, is so excitingly different from Prey and Killer of Killers, where Prey puts a period spin on the original and Killer of Killers takes the minisode anthology route. Badlands turns the corpse counting franchise on its head. Shades of Kong Skull Island, James Gunn, and Saturday morning cartoons reign supreme, but also science fiction imagery a la Frank Frazetta and behemoth perspectives seen in the video game Shadow of Colossus. Oh, and it's also genuinely hilarious? Badlands is the Predator story I never knew I needed. A thrilling call to alien wilds full of heart, healing, and heroism. Ethan Simi. Yeah, I don't know, man. This movie is sick as fuck. That's a great little blurb there. Daniel Howitt. It never stops driving forward from beginning to end with violent action and clever spin on the franchise. It's enormously fun pairing the Predator with a synthetic L Fanning to take on a killer landscape. The added depth to this world I didn't know we needed. It's funnier than I expected it to, though it sometimes felt hampered by PG-13 constraints. Regardless, a great reinvention of the franchise. Courtney Howard. Predator Badland fucking rips. You'd never expect elements from classic era Buddy Road pictures and screwball comedies to be in the sci-fi slash horror, but here we are. Irreverent, epic, and awesome. Brilliantly expands the mythos. Elle Fanning is perfection. It's also one of the prettiest looking in the franchise, thanks to Jeff Cutter's splendid cinematography. I want to begin there. Let me just say this. I was not expecting really. I don't know what I expected out of this movie, but I gotta say, I thought what was when Ethan said this movie is sick as fuck. I concur on every level imaginable, and I think one of the things I want to praise this movie for looks beautiful.
Mm.
And I'm like, wait a minute, you're telling me you can make movies look good? You can make movies look pretty? You're telling me you can actually, when it comes to big budget blockbusters, you can actually hire on serious cinematographers who are not going to just like put on a gray filter? Who are not going to wash out the colors? And further still, you're going to have something that's going to come out. It's Fox. So, or I guess we should say 20th Century Studios, whatever, but... Mm. Yes, it's kind of like coming out of the House of Mouse, but you're telling me that the visual effects not only are not ugly, not only work, but look incredible? I gotta tell you, this was like $100 million, and the visual effects in this movie, while not groundbreaking, not revolutionary, but they look really, really good, especially when the Yautja is your main character. and that VFX is throughout the whole movie, and you're on an alien world with a lot of VFX, like, Disney, what are you doing, man? Mm-hmm. Also, all other studios, John Chu, what are you doing? Like, you have a movie here that is basically all FX. Not all of it, but a lot of it is. A lot of the characters are FX characters. Mm-hmm. And it looks great. It's not at all hindered by the things that, let's just say, your average superhero movie would be. So just from that standpoint alone, we need to give out, you know, those flowers to this movie. But you made a legit Predator movie where it was about the Predator people, I guess you could say, and a lot of their customs, and you had a legit main character, like a full-fledged character with this Yautja creature. And you kept my attention all the way throughout. It was like, wow, I didn't know this was the movie we were going to get. And if I read it on paper, I would be a little bit nervous. Like, can you actually do that? Because none of the other movies did that before. They did. And I think it was better for it. This definitely stands out in the, you know, against all the other Predator movies. It's distinct. And it's just genuinely good script. And really good, cool movie moments. I mean, to me, this feels like a genuine gem and definitely something that would be worthy of, would be really interesting. I probably wouldn't be received as well, and I for sure wouldn't look anywhere near as good if it came out like 20 years ago. But overall, I gotta say, this was a blast, David.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with this. I was excited about it from the very beginning. I really loved Prey, and the idea of Yautja or Predator being the main character. You know, if I hadn't seen Prey, I would have and I heard that idea, I would have been like, oh my gosh, where are you going with this? What the fuck?
Can that be the main character?
Yeah, how can you make that your main character? And this just sounds like the most fan service
contrived or fan service maybe
fan service fan or oh my gosh I can't remember the word anyway but sounds it's basically like it sounds like someone like some super fan would make up, you know. I had a lot of fun with this. I loved the world the main character was on. I liked its little companions and the fact that I even cared about this character was pretty surprising, honestly, and it worked really well. And I like the journey that he went on. Honestly, not even just that I cared about the main character, but one other Yautja character that I cared about. It was generally surprising in the beginning. And yeah, I wish I could see more.
Yeah. Genuinely surprising that it got me to care.
Mm-hmm.
Which I could say that I didn't really care going into it, but I think it won me over at the end of it. So that's Predator Badlands. Do you feel it should have just come out in August?
Yeah, I would think so. That's good enough action movie. What else? What came out in August, though? Can't remember.
I can't remember.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that just like answers it too. It's just like I can't remember what else came on. I just probably would have. Yeah,
I think it should have been a summer movie, at least end of summer movie. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it really had any business coming out in November.
Yeah,
especially with like the because I don't know you caught, but in the movie they mentioned the Weyland Yutani Corporation, which is from the Alien franchise, and they had Alien Earth on Hulu that was happening at the same time, so I feel like maybe it would have had a better cross promotional opportunity if it had been in August. Anyway, the Rental Family movie with Brendan Fraser, we will review when you have seen it, because you for sure are going to see it. I just got back from watching it a second time, and I gotta tell you, it's definitely worth anyone's time. It's a very human movie, with some really small moments that pack a lot of punch in there. I would not expect to go into it being devastated, but it's just it gets you thinking. I thought it was a really special film, and I look forward to having that. Peter and I saw it, so we can talk about that next time we're on here.
Okay.
Well, that leads us with the finale today, which is a genuinely special movie in its own right, Frankenstein by Guillermo del Toro. Only monsters play God. Dr. Victor Frankenstein, a brilliant but egotistical scientist, brings a creature to life in a monstrous experiment that ultimately leads to the undoing of both the creator and his tragic creation. Starring, of course, Oscar Isaac, Jacob Elordi, Christoph Waltz, and Mia Goth. Here are some of the reactions. Here's Courtney Howard. This is a movie meant for movie palaces. The reason theaters were invented, cinematic splendors galore, awe-inducing and electrifying themes and poignancy burrow deeper into soul on third watch. Jacob Elordi is brilliant. And 5 stars to the couple seated in front of me who pointed like Leo DiCaprio from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood at the screen during Oscar Isaac's bathtub scene and then clap when he shows his butt. No, no, it's perfect audience at the Chinese theater. Well, we can tell that there's definitely different people who have different priorities. Mm. Chris Evangelista putting out this quote from the movie. Perhaps I thought this was the way of the world. It would hunt you and kill you just for being who you are. And then he says, I love this movie so much. Kevin L. Lee. Second viewing really solidified my thoughts. It's amazing. Victor's disapproval of the creature, his abuse of it, and his own personal disgust that such a vile, unintelligent thing could be associated with him, mirrored by the creature's longing for connection and eagerness to forgive so he doesn't have to feel hatred inside. It really is the story Guillermo del Toro was born to adapt. Zoe Rose Bryant. Ever since I read Frankenstein for the first time my senior year of high school, it's been my favorite book for reasons I couldn't always explain. All I knew at the time, while still denying certain aspects of my own identity to myself, she's trans, by the way, was that I felt an instant kinship with the creature, this tragic being that didn't ask to be alive or have any say in the body he was born into or the way he looked and only ever wanted to be loved and no longer alone. But because of the things he no longer could control or had control over, the world wouldn't let him, because no matter what he did, they'd only ever see him as a monster first and foremost, because no one ever gave him the chance to be anything else. But almost a decade later, I no longer solely see myself as in creature's sadness. I see myself in the way he initially finds beauty all around him all at times, whether he's actively trying to or not. When finally free to move around through the world on his own in this new life, experiencing it all through virgin eyes, I see myself in the way his weary heart is healed by human connection, and especially with those rare few who treat him as someone deserving of compassion and consideration and remind him of his worth that no reconstructed exterior can erase. And I do sadly also still see myself in the way he struggles against the inevitability of violence and anger in this cruel world too, despite his inherent belief system being defined by innocence and optimism, qualities he desperately tries to defend until they're savagely ripped from his soul, leaving an empty husk of hate behind. Okay. I have seen this movie now probably 5 times in the last 2 weeks. I'm not going to say I'm obsessed with it, but I am going to say I love this movie. And I think Guillermo del Toro was the perfect person to do this story, because I feel like he added in a few more extra layers. And I'm not familiar with the novel. The next time we have Peter on, we'll definitely get more in depth with it, because he definitely read it. But he himself pointed out that there were a lot of differences from what the Shelley novel actually was. So it's really interesting. But overall, I mean, I just, it's movie magic. Every part of this movie I'm just enthralled with. Everything from Oscar Isaac's accent. I hear destiny calling me. The screenplay, I gotta tell you, look, the direction is masterful, the movie looks beautiful, but I just feel like that particular script had like so many lines that were unbelievably memorable and poignant that we're going to be living with it for a while now. I mean, to me, this was great. David?
Yeah, just fantastic. I basically what I expected from this movie, from Guillermo del Toro. Like when those reviews said, like, I think even for us, when we first heard about him making this movie, we were like, yeah, of course it's him. Who else? So if you know the Frankenstein story, you basically know what's gonna happen in this movie. The some parts are different, yes, but overall you'll understand what you see. You get what you see. And it's, I don't know how many times we can say it. It's like, it's a beautiful movie. Everyone is absolutely amazing. I was genuinely surprised by Jacob Elordi. I've seen him in Euphoria. His character in that show is an asshole, worst person ever. And so the fact that I see in this, I don't see that or him really.
You didn't
in this
see
movie.
Him in Saltburn, did you? Did you didn't watch Saltburn?
No, yeah, I did watch Saltburn. Yeah,
you did watch Saltburn. Okay, so yeah, mm-hmm. He was a different, I want to say, was he really an asshole in Saltburn? No. He was a different kind of character in Saltburn.
If I can't remember, I think he might have been like the nicest one in the group. but I mean, either
saying,
way, though,
I'm not sure if that's saying much, but yeah, it's still a lot. You wouldn't expect him to pull a performance like what he has here. And I think you're speaking for all of us here, my friend. I don't think any of us saw this coming.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know he could do this. And I feel like so much of what this movie rests its shoulders on is if Jacob can deliver a captivating performance, and mm-hmm. he does. Because every little thing, every little choice that he does as an actor to bring this character to life works for me completely.
Who's the actor that played like the fish in Shape of Water? And he's been a whole bunch of other...
Doug Jones.
I'm very curious if he might have like looked at past Guillermo's movies or maybe talked to Doug Jones, but I feel like he was trying to do what he was doing. Jacob Elordi was trying to do what
probably Jones, yeah,
because there was just certain movements that he did that kind of reminded me of him, and more specifically the way he moved his hands in the movie. Mm-hmm. just something about it, I was kind of like, feel like I'm getting Doug Jones vibes. Mm. From his performance. So I'm just curious, especially because like there were some moments when you see him in the movie, it almost looks like he's gonna like fall apart at any moment when he first comes to life and all that. And it's just really interesting to watch. But you know, as he goes through the rest of his journey, I'm not seeing Jacob Elordi. I'm not seeing him in like his past roles. This is like someone completely different. And what worked obviously is the makeup, but also just the way he changed his voice too. I'm sure they might have done something for it post, but either way, you get the emotions coming out from his voice and all that, and it's fucking fantastic. One thing I loved the most too, it's very minor, but the eye light on him the entire time was so interesting, because he already, you know, you get the emotion coming from it and all that, but I find it kind of interesting that his eyes almost made it look like, you know how you flash a light on a dog or an animal and they kind of like get bright. his was like that too. And I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. And like, I don't know if that was intentional to like have us focus on his eyes, and it just worked so well that he was able to act with his eyes so much. That
I think it was. I saw an interview where Del Toro, he was asked, why did he cast? What was the biggest thing he was looking for in casting the whoever he cast for this character? And he specifically said the eyes. Mm. And I feel like, I don't know what it is about Jacob's eyes that works so well, but when you watch the film, you definitely see, yeah, I mean, that was a big reason why he got this part, and it definitely works very well.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And just like I mentioned, I think he deserves an Oscar for this. He was fucking fantastic. Everyone else was great too. Victor Frankenstein, oh, what's his name?
Oscar Isaac.
Oscar Isaac. Just exactly what I expected.
I want to also shout out David Bradley, who played the blind man.
Yes.
Very, very good. I mean, this actor, he's a character actor, obviously. And he's popped up in a couple of things here and there throughout the last couple of years. But I really do feel like, wow, this was, when I saw him walk onto the screen, I'm like, this perfect casting. And some of the moments with him and the creature are like some of my favorite moments of the whole film. Just genuinely, like, emotionally raw. But even just like the themes, like, you know, about like breaking the cycle, you know, forgiveness, that kind of stuff always works on me. And I feel like this truly does feel like the pinnacle of like all of or I guess the culmination of all of Del Toro's works, you know. This one genuinely feels like everything that he's been working to has led up to this. The craft work is impeccable. I mean, there's more I could say, but genuinely, I just
watch it in theaters.
10 out of 10. 10 out of 10. Yeah, I mean, basically.
And if you can't, you know, it's on Netflix. Watch it in the best screen that you can find. Go to your neighbors.
Yeah, basically.
So,
but yeah, yeah. We're gonna go ahead and leave it there as far as reviews are concerned. Are we about done right now?
Yeah.
Then it seems like we are. Well, we hope that you have a wonderful holiday week. Happy Thanksgiving. Stay tuned for some more projects coming your way. Here we got more movies to review when we come back next time. So stay in our red spotlight for more. Thank you, David, for being here, and thank you to the rest of you who have been watching and listening, guys. We'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.